Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed. I'm Wensley Clarkson, and I've worked inside the underworld for more than 30 years alongside police officers, forensic scientists, and criminals. My research has included prison visits, surveillance operations, police raids, and even postmortems. And now I want to take you on a journey into modern forensic science.
You're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics.
In each episode, we'll meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers. I will examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases. Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, The Secrets of DNA. My next guest on the show is Professor Turi King. With her, we are going to discuss how DNA became so important in crime investigations and how she solved a mystery that was 5 centuries old, the identification of the corpse of King Richard III. Professor Turi King is a scientist, a speaker, and author who's passionate about communicating science to the public. She also happens to have helped identify the corpse of King Richard III thanks to analysis of the body's DNA. But more about that one later. Turi's work on genetics and archaeology inspired her to join the prestigious genetics department at the University of Leicester, which is headed up by the so-called father of human DNA, Professor Sir Alec Jeffreys, who retired some time ago, but is associated entirely with human DNA, which he helped devise and develop 30 years ago. Anyway, since DNA is the key to so much of your work, Turi, it seems apt to start with that as a subject. Tell me a little bit about how you came to be interested in it and how important it is to what you do.
Okay, so I took a bit of an unconventional route with my studies. I was doing my undergraduate degree at the University of Cambridge, and I was doing the archaeology and anthropology tripos. And I was specializing in biological anthropology in the last couple of years of my degree. And we were taught about the Romanov case. So this is Tsar Nicholas and his wife and their children and doctor and servants who are killed during the Bolshevik Revolution. And their remains go missing. And in the 1990s, remains are found. And it was a combination of genetics and archaeology that was used to identify their remains. And I thought, this is a really, really interesting area. I'd love to be able to kind of combine these two fields of sort of archaeology and genetics together. So I was asking around all my tutors at Cambridge, and they all said, well, go to the University of Leicester. It's a really amazing genetics department. It's where DNA fingerprinting was invented by Sir Alec Jeffreys. Why don't you go there? So I applied and got a scholarship to do a master's degree and then later stayed on to do a PhD. And all of my work essentially had been kind of combining, at the time it was modern DNA, looking at modern genetics, but with history. So it was like using genetics to answer questions in history and archaeology. And that's basically how I got involved in it.
You've mentioned Alec Jeffreys there. Before we dig into the fascinating work you have been doing by combining your passion for archaeology and your study on genetics, I'd like to give listeners a bit of background on this extraordinary scientist. There's a section in my audiobook that covers Alec Jeffreys' work on DNA in great length. Let's take a listen.
In the late 1970s, Alec Jeffreys, born the 9th of July 1950, was a young British geneticist working as an up-and-coming professor at Leicester's prestigious Department of Genetics in central England. Its pathology department eventually went on to be hailed as one of the world's foremost forensic facilities. Professor Jeffreys was quietly developing techniques for genetic fingerprinting and profiling at a time when most people hadn't even heard of DNA. Jeffreys ran his own small laboratory at Leicester University with one part-time technician. He was, however, given considerable freedom to experiment. It was a time when technology was gradually emerging, which enabled scientists to properly study genes. Jeffries concentrated on the inherited variation of genes at first. When he felt he had them properly investigated, he switched his emphasis from products of genes such as blood groups to DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA as it's better known, is the main component of chromosomes. It carries genetic information of all forms of life. In 1978, Jeffries and his small team of one at Leicester University began working out how to detect variations in human DNA and started mapping genes in disease diagnosis. By 1981, Jeffries had pledged to his Leicester University peers that his main goal was to distinguish highly variable strands of DNA. So he and his team looked even more closely at how these genetic variations evolved. Jeffries tested out samples taken from his own lab technician before eventually uncovering the first inherited DNA variation. Jeffries knew this was the key to what he was trying to do. That's when he stumbled on what he later called stuttered DNA, or mini satellites. They turned out to be highly variable. He worked out a way to detect these numerous mini satellites. It became clear they were all variable enough to potentially provide their own uniquely informative genetic markers. But it was early days yet, and Jeffries knew he needed to continue his work on DNA in order to confirm the significance of his findings. So for the moment, he kept his research very low-key. Few outside the university even knew what he was working on.
So technically, what Professor Jeffries was working on is called DNA fingerprinting, which later became the key to solving many crime investigations. You've worked alongside Professor Jeffries. How much of your recent work is down to his invention? Because you've recently cracked one of the biggest forensic DNA cases in history, the identification of King Richard III. But you couldn't have done this without Alec Jeffries' establishment of genetic fingerprinting, could you?
Well, I use sequencing for this one. But I did use a form of DNA fingerprinting on the Y chromosome. So DNA fingerprinting, what Alec found, was that you get parts of our DNA where it's like there's a stutter. So it's like the same word is repeated over and over and again. So you get the same word will be repeated next to each other, but there might be different words in different parts of the genome where, you get another repeat. So what it is that you get one copy of your genome from your mom and one copy of your genome from your dad. So if you're going to go and have a look at one of these stutters, on the bit of DNA that you've got from your mom, you might have, say, 10 stutters of a particular word. And from your dad, it might be 15. And what this does is if you look at enough of these, it starts to differentiate people very, very specifically. And the other thing that you can do is you can use it to look at family relationships. So you can look at a child and you can go, okay, so they've got this number of stutters from their mom and this number of stutters from their dad. Oh, this person can't possibly be related because they don't have the right number of stutters from either of the parents type thing. So what I was doing for the Richard III case was, because of how our DNA is inherited, it's a very complex mixture of that of our ancestors, I could only use pieces of DNA that are passed down through the generations in a really simple way. So Richard lived over 500 years ago. And I've got to use pieces of DNA that are just passed down really, really simply. So one of these is mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA, it's in the egg. So we gals, we pass it down to all of our children, but only daughters pass it on. So if you find somebody who's related to the female line, then I can look at the DNA from them and I can see if it matches the DNA from the skeleton. Yeah. Now, the other piece of DNA is the Y chromosome. Again, that's passed down in a pretty simple way down through the generations. It has on it, putting it really simply, the gene for maleness. So only men have it, and they pass it down just to their sons. And it's passed down through the male line virtually unchanged, save for the, you get a tiny little accumulation of mutations that happen over time, but we know how those work. So what I was doing with the Y chromosome was I was looking at these little stutters. You get stutters on the Y chromosome as well. So I was doing a version of DNA fingerprinting, but just on the Y chromosome.
Ultimately, can you sum up what you discovered and what effect that has had on what we believed about Richard III?
Okay, so what you have to do is you have to treat this like a historical missing persons case. So Richard III, last seen in the choir of the Church of the Grey Friars, you come across a skeleton and you have to go, okay, so how likely is this to be Richard III? Or is it somebody who purely by chance fits everything we know about Richard III, but is not Richard III? So you have to bring all of the strands of evidence together so he's found in the right place. The skeleton comes back as being about 30 to 35. We know Richard was 32 when he died. There are reports about him having one shoulder higher than the other. He's got severe scoliosis of the spine. We know that he's died in battle. The skeleton's got battle injuries. And then you do the genetic analysis as well. You do the radiocarbon dates as well, if that's coming back as the right period. And then you do the genetic analysis. So I'm looking at the mitochondrial DNA from two living female line relatives of Richard III. So Richard III had no known living descendants. Yeah. And that's actually really, really important, because you wouldn't believe the number of people who email me and say they think they're descended from Richard. Richard left no known living descendants.
The key to this, I presume, as a complete layman here, is that DNA can last forever.
Well, so DNA doesn't last absolutely forever. So it's up until relatively recently, the oldest DNA that people were able to analyze was about 700,000 years ago, and that was a horse. But relatively recently, a colleague of mine has been involved in a project where they've managed to get DNA out of a 1.6 million year old mammoth. I mean, it's incredible. But the thing that allows for DNA preservation is ideally you want to have cold and dry. And the key thing in both those studies for the mammoth and for the horse was that they were in permafrost. And that allowed the preservation of the DNA over that length of time. I personally haven't looked at anything that old. I tend to go back just a few hundred years in terms of the skeletons that I tend to be looking at.
What you're doing, in a sense, what's in your hands, in a sense, is rewriting parts of history, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's one of the really kind of spine-tingly bits about the work that I do. So I think we'll talk about it a little bit later on, but the Richard III case, where it was identifying his remains, so one of the most famous kings of England, whose remains were missing, and doing that work and being able to show that these were indeed his remains. I can tell you, it's quite an extraordinary moment when the first sort of DNA results were coming back and it was all fitting. And I thought, oh my God, okay, I can't get too excited because I've still got more work to do. And, you know, but I did do a little dance around the lab with my best friend who I was working with at the time.
We will discover, and that particular case captivated a lot of people, didn't it? I mean, it really did have a huge effect, and the publicity surrounding it was worldwide. So you said that you treated it as a missing persons case. Can you take us through the whole investigation? How did it all start?
So the project actually started 10 years ago, way back in 2011. A lady called Philippa Langley from the Scottish branch of the Richard III Society got in touch with the university, it's the University of Leicester's Archaeological Services, about the possibility about doing an excavation in downtown Leicester in an area where we know Richard is supposed to have been buried. So we know that he is killed at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. He is brought back to Leicester and he's buried in the choir of the Church of the Grey Friars Friary in Leicester.
Which has then become, more in recent years, a car park. Is that correct?
It did. Well, it got torn down during the dissolution of the monasteries. The friary's torn down in 1538. And then the land is bought and, you know, people build their houses on it. There's a chap called Robert Herrick, who was the mayor of Leicester, and he bought the land and he put a manor house on it and he had gardens. And that partially went some way to actually protecting where Richard's grave was, because it wasn't built over. It was a garden. But there's been an awful lot of information that was already out there, which gave sort of indication as to where the friary was likely to be. It was likely to be in sort of the northeast corner of the friary precinct. We knew basically where the friary precinct was because you've got old maps and you've got roads like Greyfriars and Friar Lane. And so kind of the the precise area where Richard's grave was, we didn't know, but the general location of where the friary was supposed to probably be, that was kind of known. But I have to say, it was really extraordinary in that it was the first trench that went in, and it was 6 hours and 34 minutes in when we hit a little bit of leg bone.
That was much quicker than you thought.
Absolutely.
Why was it so important to establish what really happened to him?
Well, so he's one of our most famous kings, isn't he? And he's one of the few kings whose graves remains were lost. And for us on the team from the University of Leicester, our main aims were, could we actually find the friary building? Because the friary's been torn down. There's kind of sections of what looks like a precinct wall. But other than that, there weren't any remains of the friary itself. So our main aims were, well, could we actually find the remains of the friary? And that was what we were looking for. As I say, sort of 6 hours and 34 minutes in, we hit a little bit of leg bone. But you can't just lift sets of remains. You have to get a license from the Ministry of Justice. We don't know where we are at this point. So we know from historical documentation that there have been remains found in, you know, when they've been building the houses in the area where the friary is supposed to have been, they found remains in the past. So we could be inside the church. We could be outside the church. We could be in a graveyard. There could be thousands of skeletons here. So we don't uncover this set of remains. In fact, we keep it covered and keep it safe just in case we want to come back and have a look at the remains. We know that Richard's supposed to be in the choir bit of the Church of the Grey Friars. We don't know where we are. So we keep going.
So you were unraveling things. And the reason why I'm mentioning the car park is because I'm just trying to bring it back to basics so people can relate to how unlikely it was that you would even find it in the first place. Did you find that people were confused a little bit at the beginning or a little bit cynical about what you were doing? And then they started to appreciate how important it all was.
Well, I think we all of us archaeologists thought it was likely to be a long shot. We thought it was going to be a 2 week recce dig. We thought, okay, we're going to do 2 weeks. We'll see if we can find the friary or bits of it and work out where we are. Then maybe next year, will that allow us to kind of look at what we found so far? Let's try and hone in on where we think Richard is going to be. So when it started, I mean, we all kind of thought, well, it's unlikely that we'll find on this particular excavation, but maybe it'll allow us to understand a bit more about the friary, and then we can go on and do something in the following year. I don't think people were cynical. People were really, really interested, more interested than we kind of really expected, because on the first day before we actually broke ground, the day before, we did a sort of a little press conference, and a number of us from the team, so Richard Buckley and I were kind of the first people who kind of came onto the team, and then some of the archaeologists. And we thought, oh, you know, who's going to be interested in this? But the press trucks kept turning up in droves, you know, the ones with the big satellite dishes on the top. And it started to kind of really like, oh, my goodness, this is going to be of interest, not just locally, but much wider than that. So I didn't sense any kind of cynicism, more just an interest, really.
And what was the people's response to your discovery? You mentioned receiving lots of emails where people wanted to prove they were related to King Richard III.
Well, so this is the thing. We're all related to Richard III. It's simply a matter of degree. Just as we're all related to each other, it's simply a matter of degree. But it's the opposite way around, because DNA often can't tell you for certain about that link, because you have to have people who are related in that particular way. It has to be either an all-female line or an all-male line. And actually, those are pretty darn rare. But essentially, what happened was the mitochondrial DNA matched. So the female line relatives, they matched the skeleton. The fun bit was when the Y chromosome did not match the male line relatives. Now, I wasn't remotely worried about this because I knew from my previous research that the Y chromosome that a man has comes from his biological father. But that might not be the recorded father. So if there had been, we call them false paternities, like an illegitimacy in the family tree, then a chap's going to have a Y chromosome type that's not matching the genealogy. And there's 19 generations between Richard III and the male line ancestor of the five men that I was testing, plenty of time for there have been a false paternity or even more than one. So when this showed up, I was not remotely surprised. But again, you bring that into the statistical analysis when you're going, is this Richard III? You have to bring in all of the evidence, you know, that matches and doesn't match. And even when you bring in that evidence, you get a probability of 99.999 to 99.99999% that these are remains of Richard III. So pretty convincing that these are the remains of Richard.
Wow, that's absolutely fascinating. I know we could spend the whole podcast talking about it, but I'm going to go contemporary now because I know your expertise revolves around linking people with the same surname through DNA. Has this ever helped you solve, or have you ever been involved with solving a cold case? And if so, how did that occur?
No. So I've never been involved in anything where we've used the Y chromosome to be able to trace back to a surname to be able to be used in a cold case. But it's something that was suggested out of the work that I did, gosh, in the 2000s now. So what I was looking at was, so surnames come down through the male line, so hereditary surnames.
I know, but sorry to interrupt, but I remember somewhere, reading somewhere, that you were saying you felt you could discover someone's surname through their DNA.
Yeah, so this was something whereby I was looking at men from around the country with the same surname. So everything from the surname Smith, the most common surname in the country, all the way down to some of the very, very rare names. And what I was doing was just taking two men at random from around the country with the same surname and going, how often do they match? Because surnames in this country, hereditary surnames were brought by the Normans, but the practice of using hereditary surnames was not sort of fully taken on by most of the population until around the 1500s. And then it was becoming rare not to have a hereditary surname. And what I was finding was, so surnames come down through the male line, Y chromosome comes down through the male line. So do all men who have the same surname, do they all have the same Y chromosome? Because they're all descended from an original Mr., you know, so David Attenborough took part in my project. So are they all descended from an original Mr. Attenborough who lived, say, 500 years ago? And the Attenboroughs were actually fantastic. If you take Attenboroughs from around the country and you've got David spelling, but also a spelling variant of the B-O-R-R-O-W, it doesn't matter. About 90% of them have got identical or near identical Y chromosome types. They are descending from some original Mr. Attenborough who lived, we think, around 400 years ago.
Well, I'm not so surprised by that because of the fact the name is not that common. But if it comes to the Smiths and Browns and so on, or the Johnsons or whatever, that's not going to be the case, is it?
Exactly. So what we suggested at the time was that, look, this is not going to work for common surnames, but for rarer surnames, and most surnames are rare. So the average number of carriers for a surname is around 72, because there are so many surnames that the average number of carriers is actually quite low. So if you had a database of Y chromosome types attached to a particular surname, could it be that you go to a crime scene, you pick up a Y chromosome type, you put it into the database, and it might bring up more than one surname. But say this is a crime that requires local knowledge, and this is a surname which is local to the area. You would probably go and interview that person first, but it's investigative. It's not something which is going to necessarily lead you directly to the person, but you would go to that person first, and then you do standard DNA fingerprinting on them.
You are investigators as well as scientists anyway. Having spoken to a lot of forensic scientists, it's clear that the investigative side of it is sometimes as much as 50 to 60% of what they're doing. That brings me back to Alec Jeffries. Do you think that when he first set out to try and establish that genetic fingerprints existed, that he even realized how pivotal this would be to the world of crime and so many other areas?
So my understanding is that he had his penny drop moment on the 10th of September, 1984, where he realized what he could see was that each person was individual and that you could see family groups. And they apparently immediately sat down and started thinking about ways that this could be used. And forensics came up, paternity testing, immigration cases, this kind of thing. And actually, the first time that DNA fingerprinting was ever used was actually in an immigration case. The second time it was ever used was actually to exonerate somebody who had confessed to a crime. And it wasn't until the third time that it was actually used that it was used as part of convicting somebody. But my understanding is that within a few hours, they'd kind of thought, right, these are the things that this could be used for. Whether or not he ever envisioned just how big it would go, I don't know. I mean, it's used for everything. I mean, it's, you can now use DNA from animals from crime scenes to be able to trace back. It's all this kind of thing that you can do. It's extraordinary just how world-changing it's been. And it's always surprised me that he's never won the Nobel Prize. It's one of the biggest discoveries in the world ever.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. I wonder why he hasn't. That doesn't make any sense. I don't know what, how they really choose who wins. I've always been a bit suspicious about that, but that's another area altogether. But going to the first, there was a local murder, or in fact, I think there were two murders committed by someone called Colin Pitchfork, it was the pivotal crime case. So just to refresh our memories, let's hear about how that case played out.
Just 5 short miles away from Professor Jeffrey's laboratory at Leicester University, the chilling murder of a teenage schoolgirl had rocked the village of Enderby in the heart of the English countryside. Police had discovered the body of 15-year-old Linda Mann on a little-used footpath on the outskirts of the village on the 21st of November 1983. A post-mortem revealed that the teenager had been beaten, raped and strangled, and a semen sample from her attacker was retrieved from her body. Detectives at the time were informed by their own forensic team that the suspect's blood group profile matched approximately 10% of the UK's entire male population, and it was not practical to test millions of potential suspects. Initial police inquiries came up with a number of suspects, including one local man who was discounted after proving to detectives he'd been looking after his baby son at the time of the attack. Eventually, the hunt for Linda's killer went cold. In the summer of 1986, a second teenage girl living near Professor Jeffrey's laboratory at Leicester University set off on a journey she would never return from. At 4:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 31st of July 1986, 15-year-old schoolgirl Dawn Ashworth left a friend's house in the village of Narborough to walk home. Dawn lived in the nearby village of Enderby, where the body of Linda Mann had been found 3 years earlier. It was just a few minutes' walk away. Initially, police believed the rapist and murderer to be 17-year-old Narborough resident Richard Buckland, who appeared to have knowledge of Dawn's body and even admitted to the crime under questioning. Buckland, who had learning difficulties, also knew Dawn. He seemed to know some details of the crime that had not been made public. Under questioning, he repeatedly admitted the murder to a detective, although he later withdrew that confession. Following Richard Buckland's first court appearance, Professor Alec Jeffries, already something of a local hero thanks to his now well-publicized work on DNA, received an unexpected call from the police asking whether his new scientific breakthrough could prove that the youth had murdered Linda as well as Dawn. Professor Jeffries tested the semen recovered from both victims and concluded the same person had indeed committed both crimes. He then agreed to carry out DNA tests on Buckland's blood. He stayed up through the night to finish the work, recognizing the importance of proving the guilt of a suspected serial killer. After removing the film from the developing tank in his laboratory, Jeffries could see once again that the two girls had been raped by the same man, and that Buckland's DNA was completely different. Richard Buckland became the first person exonerated thanks to Professor Jeffrey's new DNA fingerprinting system.
Colin Pitchfork was the first person to be convicted thanks to the analysis of his DNA. Recently, his case has come to the forefront in the media once again because the parole board in the UK have said that the 61-year-old was ready to be released, and he is to be set free on license in June 2021. But let's hone in on how the case itself unfolded back in the 80s. How did the collaboration with the local police force begin?
Well, so my understanding is that these are the rapes and murders of Linda Mann and Don Ashworth, 1983 and 1986. The police could tell that the modus operandi was seemed to be the same. So they're thinking it's the same person who's involved. And what happened was it was the Chief Inspector Dave Baker who went, he'd read about this genetic case, the one that had been used for the very first case where it had been used, which was an immigration case. And he read about it in the newspaper. And so he thought, I'm going to go and approach Alec about this, who was, you know, literally just kind of down the road. So it was a local, you know, chief inspector who went, he took the initiative. Mm.
And he should be congratulated for that because, as you've just said, he only knew about it because he read about it, as far as I can tell. This had an extraordinary effect on that case and obviously thousands, tens of thousands of cases ever since. Do you think that that upped the ante because it was used in such a classic true crime case?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, so the first time that it was used was this immigration case, and it did actually make the press. But this really, as you say, it kind of turned it up a notch, really. The first time it was used in this case was actually to exonerate a chap called Richard Buckland, who confessed to one of the murders, but not the other. And everything was pointing towards this being, you know, one individual. So the first time that the DNA was used was actually to kind of go, no, this cannot be.
Well, that's a very good point, because I think so many people out there presume DNA is about getting a conviction. It can be the exact opposite. And it's terribly important to do that. We'll come to a certain section shortly about some of the mistakes that have been made. But just going back to that, then we're into subsequently DNA databases. Let's hear what they are and why they became so important over time when it comes to solving cold cases.
Today, DNA fingerprinting is acknowledged as having single-handedly brought about the biggest change ever seen in the world's criminal justice system. It helps solve crimes, identify the victims, and can even link a single event to other offences. Samples of DNA taken at a crime scene are examined through genetic records on a database for a DNA match. A cold hit is when a person is flagged up who may well be responsible. In the early days of DNA, police in the UK, US, Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, and elsewhere organized DNA dragnets to try and track down suspects, and then developed their own individual DNA databases. It's reckoned that more than 50 million people worldwide have, over the last 30 years, had their DNA tested during criminal investigations. That is estimated to have helped secure the convictions of at least a million criminals. It's also helped innocent suspects find justice and overturn miscarriages of justice. These days, police can extract DNA samples from suspects much more easily than in the early years of its development. Sometimes, suspects are simply followed until they discard a soft drink can or even a tissue if they don't volunteer for a test. In the UK, the world's first national DNA database was established in 1995. It currently contains the DNA profiles of 5.1 million people, taken from 5.8 million people. That is the equivalent of almost 8% of the population. Recently in the UK, many samples were removed from the DNA database after it was found that those profiles had been taken from people who were not convicted of a crime. Upon receipt of a DNA match from within the UK's national DNA database, the police will often proceed to arrest the suspect, although they're rarely charged on the basis of DNA profile match alone. Appropriate supporting evidence is usually required. In the US, the FBI has developed something called the Combined DNA Index System, CODIS. This contains a DNA database which holds nearly 14 million offenders and arrestee profiles. It's also seen as a vital tool for helping link local crimes to offenders outside those jurisdictions. Another important function of DNA in criminal cases is enabling the victims of crime to be identified, even if a body is unrecognizable. If the same DNA is found at two different crime scenes, it can be used to link a suspect to other offences. This allows criminal investigators to determine if a serial criminal is at large, or to establish if the victims knew one another. And this doesn't just involve murders either. Officers and forensic scientists in countries including the UK and US are today at pains to point out anyone involved in a sexually motivated attack is likely to one day have a knock on his or her door, thanks to DNA fingerprinting. One former London serious crimes detective explained, "I hope the people who think they've got away with these sorts of crimes, however long ago, are now haunted by how DNA and the latest other investigative techniques will one day bring them to justice. Because they will." Another former London police officer explained, "Until DNA fingerprints came on the scene, most people who got away with their crimes at the time of the offence no doubt presumed they'd never be brought to justice. But they're wrong. We can come and get those offenders any place, any time."
As this detective told me, DNA databases are essential to bring offenders to justice, even a long time after they've committed a crime. So why do you think DNA databases have been surrounded with so much controversy down the years?
So the big thing around databases is who should be on them. So it's if you have been arrested and convicted of a crime, do they keep your DNA on the database? But if you've, you know, been stopped and your DNA has been taken, but then it goes no further, your DNA presumably, you know, should it be on the database or not? So there's been a lot of kind of discussion around whose DNA should be on the databases or not.
Does it make scientists worried, as in the case of DNA with Alec Jeffries, that it could be used in a way that wouldn't be ethical?
So it, I suppose it depends on who's looking after the database and what's it being used for. So if it's purely for trying to link individuals to crime scenes or crime scenes to crime scenes, I don't think many people can really argue with that.
I'm going to switch in that case straight away to future applications of DNA. How is it going to develop? How much more sophisticated can it get? What are we going to see in the future when it comes to DNA?
Well, we're already seeing some pretty cool things coming out. So being able to do things faster. So the idea of sort of being able to take a suitcase to a crime scene. So you can already do that to some extent, but it's quite expensive. So it's the cost of that coming down. We can do things like we can predict what somebody's hair and eye color is likely to be. We can, if you want to, what you can do is you can look at somebody's bits of people, someone's genomes, and you can say what their likely ancestry is going to be. There's also stuff, so now people are looking at not just the genetic code itself, but something known as methylation. So this is like a layer of information on the genetic code, and it's something that switches genes off and on again. And you can actually look at the DNA from a crime scene and you can say something about probably how old this person is. You can tell twins apart. You can look at various things, so things associated with, you know, does somebody smoke, that sort of, these are all things that people are starting to look at now. So things like being able to tell how old somebody is by looking at the methylation patterns in their DNA is already something that people are able to do quite well.
What about disguising a sample of DNA? Is that possible?
Well, I mean, so it's always possible to disguise by doing mixtures. Well, so it's like things where you have mixtures of DNA at a crime scene. It can be sometimes difficult to disentangle.
That rings a bell, and that brings me very conveniently to my next question. I'd like to talk to you about false positives, but first, let's listen to how that may happen.
DNA transfer, the migration of cells from person to person and between people and objects, is inevitable when we touch, speak, or even do the basic household chores. One recent study showed that sperm cells from a single stain on one item of clothing could end up on every other item of clothing in the washer. That means even the strongest DNA profile on an object doesn't always correspond to the person who most recently touched it. You can pick up a knife at 10 in the morning, but a forensic analyst testing the handle later that same day could well find a stronger and more complete DNA profile from a person who'd used the knife four nights earlier. It's even possible that forensic analysts could find a profile of someone who never touched the knife at all. In another study, participants were asked to shake hands with a partner for 2 minutes and then hold a knife. When the DNA on the knives was examined, the partner was identified as a contributor in 85% of cases and in 15% as the main or sole contributor. That means DNA transfer can be relatively random. The mere presence of DNA at a crime scene can completely distort the truth and sometimes condemn innocent people for crimes they had no involvement in whatsoever. Homeless Lucas Anderson had a long rap sheet of non-violent crimes, which meant he had submitted his DNA to the US database. In November 2012, Murder Squad detectives in California found Anderson's DNA at the scene of a cold-blooded killing of millionaire Ravish Kumra at his mansion in the foothills outside San Jose near San Francisco. Forensic experts had matched biological matter found under victim Kumra's fingernails to Anderson's DNA database. Anderson was held in jail for a total of 5 months before his lawyer was able to produce records showing that his client had been in detox at a local hospital at the time of the killing. Later it emerged that the paramedics who'd originally responded to the emergency distress call from murder victim Kumra's mansion after he was found had treated Anderson earlier that night. They had inadvertently transferred his DNA to the crime scene via an oxygen monitoring device which had been placed on Kumra's hand.
Just like in this case in the US, there have been quite a large number of errors and people being in prison because the DNA was allegedly at a crime scene when it wasn't. What's that all about? Because in theory, that shouldn't even happen, should it?
So this is where it's not an issue with the DNA per se, it's the interpretation. So it's when people, that's usually things to do with sort of things like low copy number. So where you've got very tiny amounts of DNA. So things like touch DNA. So you can get transfer of DNA from an object. So I think, I mean, one of the biggest cases where this is known to have happened to some extent is the Amanda Knox case. So this is with Meredith Kircher, and it had been shown that it was very, very likely that there could have been transfer of DNA from one object to another, which would then implicate somebody. So this does definitely happen. You're getting a match because it does look like the person's DNA is there, but it's at such low quantity that you are uncertain. I mean, there should be an uncertainty around the results. I mean, the Amanda Knox case is kind of a classic there, where the amounts of DNA that they were starting with was, I understand, lower than what the FBI would kind of permit as a starting point. So this is where you start to get issues because you can get this transfer of DNA from objects to objects. And so the DNA is not wrong, so to speak. It's just that it's been transferred from another object. And that's where you're getting the issues come in.
Right. And how do you remove that, the influence of that other object? Or is that not possible?
So this is all about retrieving evidence at crime scenes in the, you know, using the proper techniques to do so. So, for example, in the Amanda Knox case, my understanding is that things like the bra that was picked up from the floor had been handled and then put back down again to be able to photograph it. So if somebody has been going and touching another object and then they go pick the bra up and then they're transferring DNA from something else onto the clasp, then, I mean, this is all about proper protocol.
So in that case, the technicians, if you should call them that, who collect the DNA originally from crime scenes, should probably be trained more carefully, or should they only be scientists, fully qualified scientists? What's your opinion on that?
it's training, isn't it? It's about how you follow particular protocols. But even with something like that, so for example, people kind of go, well, look, you can touch a door handle that somebody else has touched before, and you're going to get a little bit of their DNA on you. And then if somebody swabs your hand, they're going to get a bit of DNA from somebody else. I think there was quite a nice study that was done by a scientist in the US. So what they did was they went and they collected like soda cans from the staff room after lunch one day and put each can individually in a little kind of bag. Then they got knives that they had bought and they put those. They didn't change their gloves and they put those each in little individual bags. And what they found was that there was a DNA from somebody who'd been drinking their soda at lunchtime ended up on one of the knives, even though they had never been in the same room, anything like that. So it's this, it's the touch DNA. It's protocols. It's the fact that if you are getting DNA from a glass, it might have been handled by more than one person. So it's just, you know, it's bearing all of that in mind. And then it's when you come to the interpretation of the data, you always have to bear in mind that, you know, there could be a touch. This is basically, though, when you're working with amounts of DNA that are such small amounts.
Do you think the police appreciate this? Because there's an attitude from the police that I've come across where they see DNA as absolute categorical evidence. Well, actually, on the basis of what you're saying, that isn't always the case.
It isn't always that clear. I mean, this is not an area which I work in, you know, at all day to day. But certainly, it's always a case of, you know, DNA evidence does not rest on its own. It's couched within all of the other evidence.
It's such an enormous thing, DNA, and it's such a pivotal thing in terms of so many different subjects. I guess it's not that surprising. But what you're saying is we shouldn't always take it literally.
It's about how you interpret the evidence in front of you. That's the most important thing, is that if you are getting a mixture, how do you interpret this? So, and that's where human error can come in. So again, this is like all about following, you know, best practice protocols from start to finish. You absolutely have to do that through the whole thing. I mean, it's interesting how this kind of touch DNA and low quality DNA has been used really quite spuriously. For example, in Jack the Ripper case relatively recently.
I was about to ask you about it. One of his alleged victims was Catherine Eddowes. So the study of her remains was not very well carried out, was it?
Yeah, well, or they are. So Catherine Eddowes was the victim, potentially. And what they did, though, was this shawl that they looked at had sort of, you know, the provenance wasn't good. It had been in the presence of the relatives themselves whose DNA was going to be tested. So the shawl itself easily contaminated. It was just an example of how a DNA analysis, a DNA project can be carried out really, really poorly. The Mary Jane Kelly thing was actually, there's a chap called Wynne Weston Davis who believes that Mary Jane Kelly is his great aunt.
Oh, I see. She was the last known victim, wasn't she?
She is. She's the last canonical victim of Jack the Ripper. And what he wants is to be able to exhume her remains and see if they match him. So with a case such as this, I have to be absolutely certain that the person I'm looking at is Mary Jane Kelly. Now, the problem is that Mary Jane Kelly was buried in 1888 at the top of a communal grave. So there's five people underneath her and there's it's a communal grave.
So does that mean there's cross contamination?
No. So what's happened is, so she's at the top of a set of graves. Next to her is another set of graves with more people in it, either side. But what happened was in the 1940s, what they did was they took up all the old gravestones and then they started again and they laid them in the opposite direction. But there's no way of knowing how the modern gravestones match up with what the old layout was, where she actually is. And my understanding is that in digging the new graves in the 1940s, they went through the old graves and were putting bones off to one side. So what we did was a desk-based study, and this was for Pat Cornwell, who asked for this, the author. And she'd heard about Wynne Weston Davies' story. She's like, you know, how likely is this? And I said, well, you know, it's vital that I know that I'm looking at the remains of Mary Jane Kelly to see if there's a match with a great-nephew. So she's like, well, how likely is this to be? So we did the desk-based study, and we showed that there's a hot spot area of where we think that her grave is likely to be in this area. but it would involve disturbing the graves of hundreds of individuals. Even if we did that, the likelihood of coming down on a set of remains that we know are hers, also ethically, you know, potentially disturbing the remains of all of these individuals just for this particular project, if we can even identify her in the first place, is highly questionable to do that. And you have to get permission from all of these people. It was basically a no-go on a number of levels, including ethically, not appropriate to go ahead with that particular project.
That's fascinating because, you know, ultimately I can see a situation in the future where publishers and TV programs will actually rely on DNA testing. We could be talking about unsolved cases going back much further than Jack the Ripper. But then there has to be a limit on what you can do. But also, in terms of the sensitivity of people, if you're digging up graves, which is what you've just described, right? You can't just do it because you have one part of their DNA or whatever. That doesn't give you the right, does it?
So with this, it's because of the sort of the age, so 1888, you'd want to trace all of the living descendants. Going back to sort of the time period of Richard III, well, he had no known living descendants, and it's been estimated that there's sort of been between 1 and 17 million people alive today who are descended from his immediate family alone. You can't possibly ask all of them. I think the further back you go, people are less worried about that sort of thing. I mean, the really interesting thing that's becoming an issue ethically at the moment is the whole idea of forensic genealogy. The most famous case at the moment is the Golden State Killer, but it's really, I mean, it wasn't actually the very first case.
This, just to explain to our listeners, this is a serial killer only caught recently, although there was a huge gap between now and when he committed allegedly his last killing. But it was an extraordinary breakthrough that has brought him to justice. But it's rife with problems, this case, as far as I can tell.
He's committing, you know, he's doing burglaries, and it progresses to rapes and then rapes and murders in the 1970s and early 80s in California. And obviously the same person committing these crimes. And what happens is a few years ago, they opened it up as a cold case. And an investigator goes back and finds one of the original samples from one of the rapes and has DNA testing on it done that is like what you have done if you go to Ancestry or 23andMe. So looking at lots of little tiny bits of variation that you've got across the genome. And the thing about this is obviously you share half of your DNA with your parents and half your DNA with your siblings and, you know, a quarter of your DNA with your cousins and so on and half sibs, so on and so forth, nephews, nieces, this kind of thing. So what they were able to do was to put this DNA into a database. And what it showed was that there were a number of sort of third and fourth cousins. And when they did the genealogy, they could trace back to a set of great, great, great grandparents. So these people are all descended from this set of great, great, great grandparents, and the perpetrator must be as well. So what they do is then they work back down again and they go, okay, so who are all the descendants from the set of great, great, great grandparents?
And then we had an extraordinary incident where the police had to get his DNA.
I mean, it was amazing. So they come up with all these kind of, you know, hundreds of individuals and they go, well, these are all girls, so it's not them. And this one was, you know, dead and this person wasn't in the right area and so on and so forth until eventually they get down to a handful of individuals who could be the likely person. And then what they did was they actually went and they were outside his house and they got a tissue from the bin, did the DNA analysis, and it turned out to be him. But the way they did they looked for these relatives was they uploaded the DNA to publicly available database. But the people who matched and other people on the database hadn't realized that their DNA was going to be used for this purpose. And some people got bothered by it. I mean, personally, I don't care because you kind of think, well, if it's going to help solve a crime, I'm not really worried about this. But some people were bothered about this. And so it's opened up questions about, you know, I think it all comes down to sort of informed consent. If you are on these databases and you know that your DNA might be used as part of an investigation, as long as you consent to that and you know what that involves, then that's the important thing really there.
Well, personally, I find it ridiculous that people can be so sensitive when we're talking about bringing a mass killer to justice. Well, Thierry, unfortunately, we've run out of time. It's been a fascinating chat, and thank you for being on The Real Silent Witnesses.
Not at all, no problem.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses, The Secrets of DNA. In the last hour, we've chatted with Professor Thierry King about DNA, how it was first used to investigate crimes, and its future applications. Of course, genetics are quite a complicated field, But Turi has been amazing. She's actually made it easy to understand. And after chatting with her, I discovered that DNA can solve cold cases that are centuries old, like she did with the case of King Richard III. And that really is surprising. As is the fact that people might oppose the creation of DNA databases that would help bring serial killers to justice. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. It's a free world and you can think whatever you want. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you like the show, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about what you've heard. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, and is published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our latest episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.